The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook if you sign up for a 2-week trial of their service. Audible has 40,000 titles available to download. For all the details, follow the links at guardian.co.uk/audible.
You're listening to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. This week, I discuss The American with an Italian. George Clooney's co-star in his new thriller is a beautiful actress, Violanta Placido. I meet the latest star to be dubbed the new Sophia Loren. And from their brilliant pop videos to their feature films, the work of Hammer and Tongs, Garth Jennings and Nick Goldsmith, have enthralled British film culture for a decade or more. I'll be discussing big screens and small screens with this highly creative duo. Sam Brooks is back, and this week we review Palme d'Or winner Uncle Bunmi, who can recall his past lives, the re-release of Michael Powell's classic Peeping Tom, and Harry Potter's back, in case you never noticed. Yes, it's like a Thai gorilla appearing at a royal wedding. Stay tuned to find out just why. It's Film Weekly. For a while now, I've been touting George Clooney's performance in The American as one of his finest and a hot tip for an Oscar nomination. In Anton Corbijn's stylish new thriller, George plays a hard-as-nailed hitman and gunsmith, Jack, who decides he wants out, so he travels to Italy for his final job. As his icy cocoon begins to melt, Jack falls for kindly and gorgeous local prostitute Clara, and together they dare dream of a new future.
I was looking for you.
I'm here.
What are you doing tonight?
I work tonight.
Don't. If I asked you to come away with me, would you?
Come away with you?
Why not?
Together.
Together.
Forever?
Forever.
Io ti amo.
Clara there is played by Italian actress Violanta Placido. She's already well established at home, and her performance here will certainly be a revelation to a larger international audience. I was delighted to meet up with her, and I began by asking her how her and George managed to create such an easygoing on-screen electricity. Dear Film Weekly listener, I do apologise for the audio quality in this interview, but when you have just seen an actress romping with George Clooney in some very hot sex scenes for a couple of hours just before you go to interview her, you tend to feel slightly diminished yourself.
He's great. I mean, I really... If what you say is true, I must say I must owe it a lot to him and also to Anton. They created a really nice, trustful atmosphere. And also George, he really surprised me as for his artistic generosity. He really put me at ease. And it's not always like that. I've worked with other actors who are very self-centered and absolutely don't care whether you're feeling comfortable or don't care about creating a nice relationship, at least when you're working on set.
And your performance, it seemed, you know, kind of really... sort of blossomed alongside. I'd never seen you perform before, so it was a nice debut. I know you've done lots before, but it wasn't daunting that it was, you know, George Clooney, who's, you know, bigger in Italy perhaps than he even is in the UK.
Maybe, yes. No, thank you. I'm very happy for this. And I mean, obviously, at the beginning, I was a bit, you know. I was very happy to work on this movie, but I did have some pressure. But then, really, it was really thanks to George and to Anton, who were so trustful.
Yeah. What was it like filming with Anton being Dutch and George being Hollywood, but of course so used to Italy? It was like filming in Italy yourself. Did you know that area, Abruzzo? Are you from there?
No, but I have a very special connection. It's my second homeland, just by coincidence. And so that played a good part for me because I felt at home, even if I discovered some new places. Yeah. Beautiful.
Why is it your homeland? You have a holiday home?
No, some years ago I went there with a friend and I met these people that are now my best friends, and they're all musicians. There's a lot of music going on there. Even if Pescara is a small town, it's not that beautiful. I mean, I wouldn't recommend it to people, but just around, it's really beautiful.
So rugged. They're not like classic Italian Alps. Yeah, you know,
absolutely.
Kind of,
yeah, the very Western. Sergio Leone has shot his movie there. They're also called they call it the Little Tibet, because it's very mystical and it's full of places where saints used to walk and live. You find these places like carved in the caves, little churches, and the nature is really untouched. But it's really a region that I love because I love nature, and I love that sometimes you can just run away from the noises of the cities and, you know, just connect to nature. You feel God is close.
That's what the character is doing, and that's why I do mention it, because the nature of the area plays, it's almost another character in the film.
Absolutely. You can really draw a parallel with the locations. They are like harsh, isolated, but at the same time, like close to God. Clara, at the same time, is sacred and profane.
Yeah,
it's like.
What did you think when they said you were going to play a prostitute? It's a kind of classic role, because she's a, you know, we call it in English a tart with a heart.
Yes.
And she is that kind of. She works for him, for a hitman or an assassin. You know, they both live on a kind of different.
It's true.
Kind of outside of normal,
yes.
Normal society.
There is something innocent somehow about Clara. Which gives Jack the possibility to think of himself as someone else. Because that can be hard, I think, for a killer.
Who was the girl?
A friend.
A friend?
Who are the Swedes?
I'm working on that. It's going to take some time. Did she set you up?
She had nothing to do with it.
Pity. You can't stay here. I've made arrangements for you to leave town while I sort this out. Take a right outside the bar, then second left, Via Magenta. You'll find a dark blue Fiat Tempra with Pescara plates. I've marked a small town on the map, Castelvecchio. Stay there, lay low till you get my call. Don't talk to anyone. And above all, don't make any friends, Jack. Used to know that.
Tell me a bit about yourself here. I was supposed to say I don't know you. I just felt like I want to date you. tell me about yourself. What do you like? Where are you from?
I'm from Rome, and I love music too.
You are you're a singer as well. You
yes,
you've got an album.
Yes, yes. So it's something that I do together, as playing in movies. It's another passion I have, another creative aspect.
Because I think this film is going to do fantastically for you. That's why I'm talking to you. I think it's like a star-making role. It's like, who's that girl?
It's
you
know, true. Wow.
Have you been seen? Are we going to see a lot more of you? Your English is obviously fantastic, so that's good.
Well, hopefully.
Clara speaks bad English, so you have to pretend to speak much worse.
Yes, a bit worse. To make it more natural, because as she comes from a small town, it would have been a bit funny. So, well, hopefully, yes, hopefully. I would like to, you know, measure myself with other directors from other cultures. I mean, this is the beauty of this, of being an actress as well, is to discover new languages.
Who's your role model as an actress?
I admire a lot the work of Kate Blanchett or Julianne Moore. I love actresses that change a lot, that search always for something new and try not to stay, you know, caught up in just one kind of character. I think that's great, and I love their work, and also Julianne Moore. I love sometimes the frailty that she has in her roles, that kind of... Italians... No, well, there are some Italian actresses which I love, but in Italy... maybe culturally or for the movies we make, you don't get a chance so much to transform yourself. That's why if you ask me for a role model, I look outside of my country, because we tend to stay a bit caught up in what we do best, and we don't take many risks.
Well, I'm risking nothing in saying that Violanta's performance is certainly going to be a breakthrough one. She's absolutely seductive in The American. It goes on general release here in the UK on Friday, the 26th of November. But if you want to see a preview screening of the film and you're here in London on Sunday the 21st of November, all you've got to do to get a free ticket is become a member of Guardian Extra. It's free to register until the end of the year, so sign up now at guardian.co.uk/extra. Speaking of cold-eyed assassins, Zan Brooks joins me now to shoot down some of this week's releases. Welcome, Zan.
Only the ones that deserve it, Jason.
Well, we'll talk about Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, part one. We'll talk about Uncle Boonmi, who can recall his past lives. See if you can recall that. Peeping Tom celebrates its 50th anniversary. That shall come under our scrutiny. And maybe a bit of Chico and Rita.
Yeah, you can't have too much Chico and Rita.
Well, apparently you can. That's why it's got a 15 certificate. But we shall talk about that a bit later. Zan, let's start with Harry Potter, which... you saw at its premiere. I mean, I've come to it this week. I feel like the last person in the world to see this film, and that it's almost bored reviewing it because I feel like it's been out for a week already.
Well, also, don't you feel that you've been basically reviewing it for the last 10 years?
There's time for a cozy catch-up later. We've got to get the hell out of here, and soon. Potter, you're underage, which means you've still got the trace on you.
What's the trace?
If you sneeze, the Ministry will know who wipes your nose. The point is, we have to use those means of transport the trace can't detect. Brooms, thestrals and the like. We'll go in pairs. That way, if anyone's out there waiting for us, and I reckon there will be, they won't know which Harry Potter is the real one.
The real one?
I believe you're familiar with this particular brew.
I used to look forward to Harry Potter because I thought, well, okay, maybe Alfonso Cuarón's doing one, Mike Newell's doing one. Now they've settled with David Yates for the last two. It's the same music, it's the same cameraman, none of whom are bad. Of course, they're all very highly skilled professionals. I just thought, there's nothing new here for me at all.
No, but I guess it's a case of if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And if you are a fan of the Harry Potter movies, you will love this one just as much as you've loved all the others.
Yeah.
If nothing else, it's an incredibly efficient machine that basically it comes off the production line. Each one is largely similar to the last. Mm. Each one nudges the story that bit further towards its conclusion that we've been waiting 10 years for. And each one is perfectly well carpentered and lots of money has been spent on them.
Yeah, I mean, you might even call it a fairground ride in that way.
Yeah.
If you say a machine, it's almost like a...
Yeah, or a monument. Mm. You know, they've taken these books that are warm and supple and witty and
are they? You know, I've never read one.
They are.
Have you?
They are. Good. And they've made these great, glittering, slightly cold monuments to them, which seem to work. I mean, you know, they don't even seem to work. They work.
They work in terms
they
of commercial
entirely
work.
Satisfy.
Yeah. And most people are even artistically quite happily with them until I'm feeling now. I think people are sort of going, you know what, out comes my cloak of invisibility. I'm going to say, do you know what, I've really fucking hated the whole lot.
I really can't bear them. I have to say, I really despise them. Perhaps because they're so brilliantly made, but they're airless and cold, and I feel that they hate me back just as much.
Well, maybe that's that. There's some kind of spell in there that you know that works both ways. I mean, I just got the sort of formula of it suddenly is so laid bare. I'm like, oh, well, which hobbledehoy English character actor is going to pop up next?
Yeah, there's the great the thing I always think when you see people like Bill Nighy, Reese Iffens, Julie Waters, Helen Bonham Carter wandering around these films, I'm always reminded of those stories about like Beyonce being paid $5 million to sing
Philip Green's bar mitzvah.
Yeah, to sing at a kid's bar mitzvah or something like that. And you know, and it's great money. They don't have to bring their A game, and they can just kind of swan around. And again, here you've got these great actors, and then you've got these three kids who really haven't quite grown into the part, and that's possibly not their fault because they haven't been given character development. I think that Rupert Grint is probably the best of them.
Isn't it odd that they haven't been given character development, given that they've been going for 10 years? They
yes,
go through school, they're getting older, they should be puberting, doing what 17-year-olds do.
There is something fascinating about this phenomenon, the way that it hasn't really developed, the way that it has for all of its spectacle and stage set pieces and special effects, there's a sort of eerie lack of suspense to the whole thing.
Isn't there? I mean, even Voldemort's supposed to be sort of frightening in some way. He's not.
No.
I've also forgotten what anyone's doing. I mean, a Thewlis pops up and you kind of, oh, well, I can't quite remember what he did. Tim Spall pops up and you think, yeah, wasn't he a mouse in number two? And now I've sort of forgotten what they're supposed to be doing, other than being Tim Spall. Oh, yes, he's part of the Harry Potter gang. He must appear at some point.
It's a billion-dollar narcotic, this film.
Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. Do you know what Hallows are?
But they'll tell you in part two, which
comes
out in July.
There's a whole shadow play where they sort of say, and that's
I like the shadow play. That was my favourite bit of the film.
That was the best bit, but that was supposed to explain what the Hallows were, and I
sort of zoned out. No, I was too busy looking at it. I was too busy thinking there's some real artistry and warmth and care gone into that. Yeah,
exactly. Gave it your extra star there. Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. We will review part two because we have to.
We have to.
Maybe there'll be some. Maybe it'll be like Zabriskie Point and they'll all just have massive sort of sex at the end of
it. Or Vanishing Point, and it'll just. Was it Tulane Blacktop? Where the film catches in the gate and it all just sort of blows up.
or Inglourious Basterds, where it all kind of...
let's write the ending
Hogwarts
for it now.
Goes and the Hitler dies. Brilliant.
They're all robots, I think.
A change of pace, Zan. If I may take you back to recall a past life, you were at the Cannes Film Festival this year. You famously said you hadn't seen The Winner, which is fair enough because you hadn't seen The Winner.
I hadn't.
I'd seen The Winner. It was called Uncle Bunmi, Who Can Recall His Past Lives, and it sounds a little bit like this. There's a bit of Thai for you. Anyone out there will probably know that that was a bit where a gorilla appears at dinner. Zan, it won the Palme d'Or. You must have been thinking, have I missed a masterpiece? So now that you have caught up with it, what did you think? Did you think, well, good? Well,
do you know, I think I almost could have ventured more of an opinion about Bunmi before I saw it than I can now. I'm more perplexed than ever.
Explain it to me.
It's a ghost story without the story. It's a free-floating haunting or seance. It's about a widowed farmer who is dying of kidney failure. He returns to the forest to sort of wrap up his affairs. And there he is visited by the ghost of his dead wife and by his son, who is now a monkey spirit with red eyes.
Yeah.
There's also a scene in which a princess gets it on with a catfish.
Yep.
There's also a long introduction with a water buffalo.
Yes, don't forget the water
and
buffalo.
And now I'm struggling.
And then there's a scene in a sort of Thai hotel in a town.
Yeah, and it's another one in a cave.
Yeah. All very beautiful in their own way.
All very beautiful and all deeply, deeply mysterious, which I think is...
In a good way or like a what way?
I think a little bit of both. I think that it is an absurd film, and I think that it's knowingly so, but that's not to say that it's wanting to be seen as a comedy. I don't think you're being invited to even chuckle.
No, we're neither laughing with it or at it.
No.
We're talking about anime. There's a kind of spiritual kind of subdivision of Zen Buddhism.
Yeah.
And I think this is where this is at.
I think it is. I'm not really up on my Zen Buddhism. I could identify, some of the tenets of Buddhism in there,
yeah.
but these are sort of little touchstones. They're not underpinning it. They're almost like a sort of a hopping off point. And it's a film about life and death and reincarnation.
This is a film where people are having dinner and a monkey appears out there, and then he goes, that's my nephew, that's my son.
And that's fine. It's not like, God, there's a monkey. Here's a monkey.
Yeah. Oh, because that's my son. And everyone goes, all right, Bunmi. Carry on. Where is the Palme d'Or now that it's been given to this? What do you, does it cheapen the
Way
Palme d'Or?
Out in the jungle, I think. Lost swinging in the trees. I think it was a perverse choice. I can sort of understand it because I think that Tim Burton likes his monkeys.
He does.
And I think that he was looking for something unusual and he was looking to make a statement. I think that there were more satisfying, cohesive films at Cannes than this. I'm making
in
it
the
sound
Western
like
tradition.
In the Western tradition. And that is maybe a disclaimer. That is something that I have to admit, that this isn't a film in my natural terrain. But I wonder if in Thailand it's in their natural terrain too. I think that this is way off in the jungle.
Yeah, it didn't look like The Beach, done by Danny Boyle.
It doesn't at all. I'm making it sound like I didn't like it. And I think I kind of did like it. I would actually quite like to see it again. I think that it is a film that may well repay further visits.
In a monkey suit.
In a monkey suit. But it is purely perplexing and I think totally opaque.
I'm sort of fond of it.
I'm fond of it.
And I'm glad it's there. I'm sort of glad it won the Palme d'Or in a way. And if you want to, we did speak to Apichak Pongvirasattakul, who is the, or Joe, as he's known sometimes, after he won the Palme d'Or and talked about that. It was quite nice for an Eastern
film to win, and a way of telling to kind of come into it. I mean, Oshima does it in Japanese films, and that's really odd, you know, people sort of having eels coming out of themselves and all that. That's quite different as well. And I like it sometimes when Kang kind of goes, well, you know what, the Western stuff wasn't all that. Let's give it to the kind of hippie stuff.
And put this out this week against Harry Potter, and you think, thank God for a film like this. Thank God for somebody making something weird and risking falling flat on his face.
Strange enough, as a 17-year-old, Harry Potter would probably skin up an enormous fat joint and go to the Everyman and
you'd
watch.
Think it was a masterpiece,
wouldn't it? Rather than me sort of mucking about trying to get into Hermione's.
I think that if they hadn't already made it, I'd get Joe to direct the final Harry Potter.
Oh,
Wouldn't that be good?
Great. Oh, Zan, the ideas we come up with.
And they just stay here.
Instead, yes, I know. But we can talk about 50th anniversaries. There are a lot of 50th anniversaries this year. I never knew that 1960 was
your birthday.
No, it's, thank you very much. 1960 was a very good year for film. Everyone sort of said 1939 was the great year with Gone with the Wind. But 1960 is throwing up, because this year is the 50th anniversary. We've had Abu Dussouf, or Breathless.
Yeah.
We've had Psycho.
Yep.
And now we get Peeping Tom by Michael Powell, which, when it first came out, was greeted audiences in cinemas like this.
Look out! Look out! Look out! Take care. You are being watched. We repeat, take care, for you are now alone with a killer. We warn you, don't let him see the fear in your eyes.
There we go, Zan. An absolute classic that Michael Powell, I mean, audiences who loved Michael Powell would have known The Red Shoes, which we've talked about here. They'll know Black Narcissus, they'll know A Matter of Life and Death. This is very different.
Yeah, Michael Powell is one of my favourite directors of all time, I think. And Peeping Tom is very different from those sort of sensual, wanton, strange films that he made. Like, my favourite, I think, is Canterbury Tale. This was a film that he made when he was slightly down on his luck. His career was fading and it was a bit of a gamble. And he tried to do this grubby psycho thriller that's actually a satire on the whole kind of madness of making movies. And it absolutely scandalised everyone. The critics were kind of in lockstep against it. And the distributor promptly sort of dropped it, and it sort of disappeared without a trace and destroyed his career.
Can you see why?
I can see why, because it's interesting you mentioned Psycho. It's an interesting companion piece to Psycho. Both are films about voyeurism, and both are films that force us into a weird, queasy identification with the killer who is also in some ways a victim. And that's a very uncomfortable sort of transaction to have to make. Peeping Tom does it more explicitly. And also, I think Hitchcock was a bigger filmmaker who could kind of ride out the furore in a way that Powell couldn't. And it did destroy his career in a way that few films really do. There's the great myth of the film that destroys you. And this is probably one of the very, very few examples.
Yeah, no, there are a few I wish that had destroyed people's careers.
Yeah, well, we've talked about one of them today, haven't we?
Oh, poor old David Yates, where his name is.
And if it weren't for Martin Scorsese basically leading the charge to bring it back into the light in the late 1970s, then Powell would presumably have stayed in his cottage in Gloucestershire. It is a great film that was fated to be maybe a little bit ahead of its time, and also came too late in Powell's career for him to kind of cope with it.
We talked about those other 50ths. I look at Psycho again and I always think, wow, that's kind of cool. That looks great still. And I look at Abu Dussouf and I think, my God, they made that yesterday. Mm. It just looks so fresh. I don't know if Peeping Tom's quite got that kind of startling newness. It looks to me of its time in the way the other two don't, or do you not agree?
I do agree. I think that it is a bit of a timepiece. I don't think it's one of Powell's absolute best, but it deserves to be seen, and it's, I think, a great film. It's certainly not a sordid, disgusting little abomination in the way that it was labelled. It's a brave, significant
film. Is it a slasher
film? Is it a slasher film? Yes, I think it is. Hmm. I think it is. And I have no problem with that.
I mean, that was kind of the first, must have been maybe the first slasher film. I mean, unless Psycho beat it to it in a way. But
I guess so. I guess if there's a precedent as well, it's M. It's Fritz Lang's film, which also tries to sort of make you at least sympathise with a character who is irredeemably awful.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, that's 50 years. Well, actually, we should wish it a happy 50th anniversary.
Happy birthday, Peeping Tom.
Yeah. Before you go, Zan, Chico and Rita, who I had the makers of it on the show last week, a sexy, swaying dream of a movie, it says on the poster, because that's what I said. And music, is it your sort of thing? I mean, I'm jazz, Cuban,
yeah,
sex.
Yeah, you are.
I like
it's more your kind of thing. I'm not, really. I liked it. Mm. I thought it was very well made. It's got this sort of sunny, brassy kind of swing to it. It was maybe a bit too smooth and groomed for me, but I love the animation, the rotoscope animation.
You like that style?
I like that style, the waking life style.
What do you think about a cartoon getting a 15 certificate because of full frontal nudity?
I think that's only a good thing, and I think the Pixar people should take note, particularly with all this 3D.
Sex Toy Story 3, another great idea born here on Film Weekly.
We should really patent these.
Thank you, Zan. For more of Zan's ideas and musings on the world of film, go to guardian.co.uk/film. Now, using a podcast spell worthy of Harry Potter himself, I've jumped back in time and location as I'm here on a barge in North London, in N1, with two men who've enlivened and enthralled us both on the big screen and small screen with their videos for Blur and Bentley Rhythm Ace and their film work on Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and most recently The Son of Rambo. They are collectively Hammer and Tongs, but individually they're Garth Jennings and Nick Goldsmith. I'm delighted to say they're both here with me now on Film Weekly celebrating the Hammer and Tongs collection. And Garth, you're actually modelling something from the Hammer and Tongs collection, a beautiful orange cardigan.
Yes, it doesn't come with the DVD, but it's certainly something I chose to wear to, you know, enhance the ambiance and go with the whole collection vibe.
It was really lovely going through your collection. Actually, I must say, 130 minutes worth of stuff. You know, it's time to bring out a collection. You've got that double album. You've reached that kind of artistic kind of, you know, point, peak there, Nick.
Maybe we're getting old.
Yeah. Did you feel that? I mean, it is. Well, it says 1989 to now, 2010. So you've been doing this for quite a long time.
Yes, we recently there was the UK Music Video Awards, and we got given the Icon Award this year, which was incredible, an amazing thing to have. But in watching everything that we've done, when they did the award, it did make you think, wow, we have been doing this for almost 20 years now. It's a long time.
Blimey. And that, you getting Icon Awards is a bit odd, because, I mean, actually, there's one of the things in your video, one of the extras, is I think it must be your first award, the MTV Awards from Dublin, where you won it for the Blur video with the milk carton, which is standing right behind me. He's not moving, thank God. That must be odd, because that sort of kicked it off for you, really.
That was the first one that really sort of, yeah, it was sort of went outside of just getting a good reception on TV. It was sort of internationally recognised and things like that. And people really sort of adopted it. And they still, you know, there's fan sites for it. And people dress up as milk cartons at the Glastonbury Music Festival. That was the one that really sort of tipped it for us, I suppose, yeah.
Well, I mean, whose idea was the milk carton? Let's get that right started now.
Who's responsible for this silly business? That was one of my silly sketchbook ideas. And again, like a lot of our music video ideas, they start off as something quite odd. And you think they're never going to go with this. You know, say to Blur, you're not in the video very much. In fact, you're only in it for a few seconds. And actually, the whole video is a milk carton, which will be a man in a suit running around in a green screen studio. And you think they're never going to go for it. And they did. Thank God.
You put some of your short films on the DVD as well. Some of those are very old. They look very old. Is that the idea?
Yeah, some of them go back to when I was at art school. There's one called Toast the Cat, which is a little 2-minute animated film about an animal hero, you know, a cat that basically saves the day and, you know, a ludicrous story.
He pops out of a toaster into space, well, onto an aeroplane.
Yeah.
It happens quite often. Actually.
Yeah, it's a straight-ahead cat, you know, being cooked alive type story. But, you know, there were actually quite a few short films we had. And, of course, the trouble is when you're making short films for yourself, you use people's music, you have people in it. And then when you come to publish a DVD, the permissions scenario is quite tricky. So quite a few little short films couldn't make it. There's one I made called John Bon Jovi's Pool Cleaner. And you can understand why that one's not on there. But it's something I'm really proud of. But anyway.
Hello.
Hello, Jarvis, it's Garth. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm all right.
So, can I start by talking to you about Help the Aged?
Yeah, go on then.
Well, it's ages.
You've got some of the stars to come and give you audio commentaries as well. Did you have to track them down? Was it difficult? Were they kind of like, oh, I'd love to talk about that. I mean, Jarvis is particularly funny.
Yeah, well, the thing was, we realised right very early on it would be lovely to talk to the bands again, A, because we haven't seen them since we made the videos with them. You normally just get 2 hours with them to film them, go, get out, and then they're off again on their tour. But also, they're a nightmare to pin down anybody. I mean, so what we did was we phoned them all up. We got their agents to give us their numbers, and they agreed to a 5-minute chat on the phone, because anyone can do that. So they're all telephone calls with, you know, Norman Cook, Jarvis Cocker, and all those sort of folks, Graham Coxon from Blur. And it went, it was much more fun. It sort of made it quite relaxed. And it was interesting saying, asking them, did you actually even like this video we made for you? Because you never find out. And some of them weren't so happy with the final result. And it was quite nice chatting to them about that, and maybe, you know, talking it through, working these things out.
I'm surprised in the 90s, because obviously that's when you came of age, but if you can remember them, you weren't really there. I'm surprised any of this lot can remember making some of your videos.
They all remember the video shoots, because they're the only time when they're forced to get up really early. It's like a horrible mark on their brain.
When you did get on to make the films Hitchhikers, I mean, it was sort of reminding you that suddenly there were all these videos, and suddenly there you were with Martin Freeman, who was a local lad, but now of course he's Bilbo Baggins, so he's huge. But Sam Rockwell, Mos Def, two of my favourite American people. I mean, obviously, quite like Barack Obama, but they're in a different sphere, really.
Yeah.
You know, working with like real film people on a project which obviously you'd love for ages. As you said, you'd practiced very well, and you were obviously kind of very happy with techniques. But doing it for a feature film, was there a kind of, oh, this is what we wanted to do secretly?
Yeah, it wasn't intimidating at all. That was the thing. I think maybe because we'd spent about 8 months prior to really being fully attached to the project, working on it. So we'd sort of slowly sort of got ourselves more and more engaged in the thing. So when it came to actually somebody saying, OK, you're making it, it wasn't a huge, it was an unbelievable day. It was a lightning bolt day, but it felt like it was a natural step because we kind of got ourselves so deeply involved in it. So when you meet people like Sam Rockwell, and of course they are people. You say film people, they are just people, really. And the nice ones are they just want to make it as much as you do.
Yeah.
And that's just glorious. So it didn't feel like a million miles away from the work we'd done before. We were still making a lot of puppets and trying to make things work and trying to keep things exciting and to tell a story, but just on a ridiculous scale. I mean, it was off the charts. It really was.
Yeah, it was almost like a BBC Saturday night game show. So many trap doors to fall through.
Yeah.
I'm surprised Vanessa Feltz wasn't involved.
Yeah.
There's an idea for your next film. Moving on to Son of Rambo, which, as you know, I'm very, very, very fond of. Indeed. It was a sort of, I like it because it kind of, it's you doing all your filming stuff, making films, but then there's another story on top of it, that kind of really lovely kind of friendship story. And then here you are, two of you, as you say, 20 years sitting on a barge together. It never occurred to me when I was watching that it was about, you know, you two in that respect, because it is about friendship. But is there a sense that you kind of knew what you were doing because you have this strange friendship? Not that you've been friends since you were that young.
No, I think Son of Rambo was very, was the desire to make it was really, I mean, even though Nick and I both like the idea of these kids making films like we used to do, what really drew us to it and what made us stick with it through the years and trying to get it made was the fact that it was trying to capture how friendships were at that age, that lovely time in your life when friendships meant something much more than they did previous to that time or even afterwards. It was a very special time. Trying to capture that feeling was the mission, and using the filmmaking and the innocence of the characters and all that sort of stuff was merely serving that story. That's what Nick and I really sort of engaged with. As far as it reflecting our own friendship, it was more like, I think that it was never the goal. It wasn't like, let's capture our friendship. Because we're, you know, a peculiar odd couple. We're, you know, more like Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon, you know, in that respect. So it wasn't like that. But certainly trying to capture how friendships were for us as kids, that was the mission.
It's very interesting when you say that the idea was to capture friendship at that age of 13, not necessarily imbue it with your own kind of essences of friendship. when you have a film, like when this is what I'm bringing it all back to. You said a video that starts with the idea, yeah. Milk carton walking down the street kind of thing. Does a film's born of a similar germ that you have to keep that in mind as well, like capture the essence of a 13-year-old's friendship?
Yeah, it definitely didn't start with a plot, Son of Rambo. It started with just a bunch of notes about that period. Obviously, it included our filmmaking experiences, but mainly it was these extraordinary friendships and the little things I learnt about those people once I got older, the sort of tragic behind-the-scenes stuff and the truth that I hadn't spotted when I was that age, and all these funny little episodes with French exchange students. It literally started as, how can we capture all of this? Because it feels like there's a film in there. And that's very much like music videos. It's like, I feel like the evolution of man will go very well with this Fat Boy Slim track. I'm not quite sure how we're going to do it, because we can't afford to go Jurassic Park on it. But maybe we get some rubber creatures, but that feels like the right way to go. And so a lot of it starts with gut feelings like that, and then you're just trying to work out how on earth to A, turn it into something like a story, or B, even make it, appear on screen.
Well, I think it's lovely to collect all of those things and all those memories on a disc and then see how those germs come, because it is sort of very individual and idiosyncratic what you guys do. And it's great. And all you do all that thinking here on this barge?
Yeah, I mean, we've been on the barge 8 years. Prior to that, we were in a grotty little place in Soho. But essentially, it's just tea and biscuits like anything. That's where it all comes from, and just goofing about.
Yeah. So the British film industry for you is powered by tea and biscuits?
We're on a barge. I mean, a lot of people, we often get interviewed for things, and people say, "Yo, there's a barge."
I can hear a barge going past. There's
some lovely real sound effects going on for you there. You get interviewed, and people say, what are your feelings on the film industry and British film industry and all this sort of stuff? And you can see now why we never have the right answer, because we're completely dislocated from the whole world. We're just two blokes and a dog on a barge.
Yeah. The UK Film Council being had nothing to do with it. If British Waterways would go up the boat, you'd be reels trouble.
Yeah. Yep, we know everything. British Waterways used to have the boat next door to us, so we had our finger on the pulse.
Garth, Nick, congratulations on so many years of Hammer and Tongs and collecting it all together. Lovely to have you on Film Weekly yet again. You are working on a new project, though. This is not the sort of difficult third, the treading water third album. You are going to come up with some more stuff, aren't you?
Yeah, it's exciting. Unfortunately, it's top secret, but it's very much a sort of a big thing that we're very much looking forward to making.
How many biscuits will this film take?
It's already taken over 6 million biscuits to get this far, so God knows it's at least 2 years ahead, so, do the maths yourself, yes.
I'm on to Huntley and Palmer's already. You should be fine. Garth and Nick, congratulations. Thanks very much for coming on.
Thanks, Jason.
The Hammer and Tongs collection is out on DVD now, as is A Town Called Panic, the brilliant Belgian animation that Garth and Nick brought over to the UK and have been championing because it's just very funny and they're good at animation. Zan and I actually reviewed Town Called Panic very favourably here on Film Weekly a few weeks ago. You can, of course, listen to our entire back catalogue of programmes at guardian.co.uk/filmweekly or via iTunes. Keep an eye on our Facebook fan page, Film Weekly Fans, that's us. We're always running competitions on there. Maybe we'll get something from Garth and Nick to give away, because last week we had an Oliver Stone documentary, South of the Border, in which the director goes to South America to look at how socialism is on a rampage there. We asked you to name the larger-than-life figure who was president of Venezuela. It is, of course, Hugo Chavez. Loads of responses, but the first three names out of the hat are Jack Truin from London, Jamie Dunn from Glasgow, and Ben Jones from Liverpool. You see, congratulations to you three. It pays to join us on Facebook. The music we've been featuring on the show this week is the soundtrack to The American by German composer and pop star Herbert Grönemeyer. Ja, das ist so funky. From me, Jason Solomons, for this week, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
Don't forget to start your free 14-day trial of audible.co.uk and to download your free audiobook. Head to guardian.co.uk/audible.